Hi, I'm Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sharon.
Hi, it's really good to be here. Thank you, Frank, for the honor. When I get nervous, I smile a lot, but I'm a little worried about that tonight because Richard might see the shine of my gold teeth back there. And I might get out of some motel somewhere and he might pull out the ties, and I don't know, so. But it's really nice to be with all of you because you are my family of understanding. I've grown up here. And like it or lump it, I'm a product of the Pacific Group. And Alcoholics Anonymous is my number one priority in life, and it has made the difference in me breathing in and out in life. So I'm really glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be able to share a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope with you. A little bit, so I want to try to get going. I was born in Iowa, and that was my first resentment. And I started to drink when I was 13 years old, and like Barbara, it was a 57 Chevy, but I had a little more class. I was sitting on the hood. And we passed around some Canadian Club and some Schlitz beer, and I felt skinny, and I hadn't reached puberty yet, and I felt not a part of these people I was with. And by the time the bottle came around for the third or fourth hit, my nubs started to grow, and Lauren Bacall slid off the top of that car, and life started for me. Alcohol changed me. I drove a car that night. I blacked out. I had a lot of fun, and everybody in my head got drunk. All those people that live up there got drunk. And we had a good time. And from that point on, alcohol was important in my life. It became more important as my disease progressed. It became more important as it changed my life for me. It seemed to make it, as Clancy says, it became technicolor, from black and white to technicolor. And I think in Iowa there wasn't really a chance to get too drunk too often, but I managed. And in college I was in college in the 60s, and in the 80s, it was just say no, but in the 60s, it was just say thanks. So we had a lot of drugs that were passed around. But I always had my alcohol with me, and I always washed it down with my alcohol. And alcohol was real important to me. I started to take geographics at an early age. When I was 18 years old, I found myself fighting with my father, getting drunk with the family priest, not talking to the psychiatrist, having suicide attempts. Alcohol was beginning to change my life in ways that I had no choice now. And I ended up in New York City, 19, 20 years old, working at a job that required a lot of skill and never sleeping at night because I was searching for truth. I would drink in the bars till 4 in the morning. I would do some uppers, and I would go out and look for truth, and then I would take a handful of acid, find truth briefly, come down, do some more uppers, drink some more, and go off to work. And I did this in New York for a long time until I had a nervous breakdown. I had anxiety attacks, and I identified with Mary Ann when she talked about breathing into a paper bag, because I used to have to do that to ride the subways. And I ended up back in college, and I went for my art classes, and I had no more natural talent was left. I didn't know that was a part of me that I gave up for alcohol. I would sit down in front of a canvas, and I would be dead. I'd have to get chemically induced to create something. I ended up fighting with my father again. That was the last time we were to have any sort of civil words. And I ended up in Colorado, and I wanted to be a cowboy. And from there, I met Bob Dylan, or I think it was Bob Dylan. I came to California, and I'm on the run. I did not know that the grass was greener because the other guy took care of his lawn. I hadn't figured that out until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. A speaker named Norm Alpe told me that, and Norma was a good old-timer. He didn't give you truth and then let you sit with it. He gave me a little hope, too. He said, if you're a good newcomer with us, then, you know, we know what you have is a lot of fertilizer. So don't worry, we're going to make a good lawn with that fertilizer. And Norm gave me hope. He gave me truth, and then he gave me hope. And that happens around here a lot. There's truth, and then there's hope. There's answers. It's a solution-oriented program. It's a dynamic program. It's in the now. And there's some newcomers' hands, and I'm really glad that you're with us tonight. Maybe you're not glad, but I'm glad. And I ended up in California turning 21, dancing with the Krishnas in Westwood with, you know, my peace sign in one hand and my one finger in the other. And I just was angry and peaceful at the same time. I couldn't quite figure it out. And at 21 years old, I ended up living with my mother and father. And my dad and I did not speak to one another. My mother said I could stay in that house as long as I didn't cause any problems for the family, and I didn't have any drugs in that house. And so what I did was I drank a lot, and I ended up in those taverns in that local town. And my dad and I wouldn't look at each other, and we couldn't sit at the same table together. And that Thanksgiving at my grandmother's house, they sat me a place with the children at the card table. They didn't know how to talk to me. They didn't know how to relate to me. They were worried about me. I come from a non-alcoholic family. I am it. And They didn't know the disease alcoholism, and neither did I. I had a pancreatitis. My gallbladder wasn't functioning, but the family doctor was giving me Valium because he wasn't looking for alcoholism either. And I was very sick, and I ended up at an organic farm because somebody said he'd take care of me. And that was a lot of work. It wasn't a lot of rest, I'll tell you that. I had some surgery, and we did this organic living. They took away my cigarettes, they took away my alcohol, and they gave me organic pot to smoke. And so that's what we did, this organic community. We just worked and tapped maple trees and made our own bread and ground our own berries and buzzsawed the wood and chopped the wood. If you wanted tea, you had to chop wood. It was really a lot of fun. I would get thirsty a lot is what would happen, and I'd have to get drunk. And when I got drunk, those people looked at me funny. Those people said that I didn't belong with them. And I didn't care because alcohol was more important to me. I finally got blackballed from that community, which was just fine, and they went to primal therapy, and I went to scream at the sheep. We had organic sheep, and I got drunk and screamed at the sheep and tended to my organic pot. I was growing a half acre of that, and we put load and load and load of sheep dung on that pot, so it was great stuff. It was 12 feet tall, and it was like just a forest of pot. And you know, that summer when I would smoke it, it was great. You just, you know, you'd smoke it and then you'd bleat like a sheep. It was great stuff, you know. But I was out there. I was living by myself. I was smoking this pot. I was drinking my wine, and occasionally I'd get some money together and go into town and get really drunk in the bars. And I was going to turn a dope deal and get out of town, and me and my dog were going to leave. I don't know where we're going, but we're going. I harvested my pot. I went to turn my dope deal. I forgot the pot back at the farm, and I joined the carnival, and it was that simple. It was just the next thing to do. And I ran a shooting gallery, and I joined this carnival, and I called my mother from Arkansas, and I made her cry now. I can't talk to my dad now. My mother cries. And so I'm just not going to call home anymore. It's much too painful. I didn't feel like I was a part of that family since that Thanksgiving dinner. I knew I didn't belong to those people at all. Alcoholism had taken that feeling of being a family member away from me, and I didn't care. I had to drink about it. It hurt, but I just couldn't care about it. It hurt too much to think about. I was drinking about things like that. Parts of my soul were beginning to just go, and I didn't care because alcohol was more important than anything else in my life by this time. I was 22 years old. I got busted for drugs. I ended up in Bogalusa, Louisiana, thrown in jail. The skunk went to jail. The dog went to jail. The new boyfriend went to jail, and after being in there about a week, they came and got me and took me to an attorney's office in handcuffs, and I was disheveled, and I was a mess. I wouldn't eat the grits, and I screamed for my rights all the time. They didn't want to give me my rights. And I ended up in this attorney's office where my father had flown in and hired, and I couldn't look at my dad, and my dad couldn't look at me, and we sat there a foot away from each other in the chair that day. And all I remember was I'd take a glance over at him, and his jaw would just be tight, and my dad and I have talked about that day, and he said the only thing I told him all day was I wasn't guilty, because I was never guilty. It was your fault that I was ending up, my life was ending up the way it was. And I got out of jail, and I ended up in New Orleans because they said to go make some money. I was going to pay a fine, and I love New Orleans. I fell in love with New Orleans. I was thinking today when I was getting dressed and putting on my suit and my nice shoes and my earrings and my watch. I was thinking of the way I used to dress going down Bourbon Street to work. I used to wear these platform shoes, which I will not wear to this day. I broke a lot of bones on those platform shoes being drunk, walking in the French Quarter. But I would wear these big black platform shoes, fishnet stockings, short, short, short little skirts with zippers at the front, body suits, usually in fire engine red. I would have this platinum blonde wig on. My face would have been made up by my drag queen friends, so I had a little heart mole here and a little heart mole there and a lot of glitter. And I would have my pet skunk on the leash. And he had a rhinestone collar and a rhinestone leash. He was good for a lot of drinks in a bar. Crank was real good for a lot of drinks. He liked rum and coke. But I would walk down to work like that, and people didn't know what I was. And I was really glad that people didn't know what I was because it made me feel comfortable. I was building a wall around myself, and part of it was the way I looked. It was the way I acted, it was the way I felt about myself, and it was the way I looked. And when you build a wall, you become your own prisoner, and that's what I was becoming, was my own prisoner. I lived in New Orleans for 3.5 years. I drank hard and heavy in that town. Jose Cuervo Gold was my drink of choice, and on a night like tonight, Cinco de Mayo, you know, I'd be out there with the best of them. But I drank tequila because, you know, instant gratification seemed too slow, and tequila would just do it right now. And I remember Father Bill speaking at this meeting, and he talked about his martini and how it looked, and he talked about how it sounded, and I got thirsty when Father Bill was talking about his martini. I thought, now how does tequila sound? And I was laying in bed about 2 weeks later, and I heard this guy up the block start his Harley on a quiet street. And it just filled the whole block. And I thought, that was what tequila did for me. It just kick-started my life. You know, it got me going. And I had a bottle of tequila in my bag and a bottle of tequila on the bar that was mine. I tended bar in that town, and I passed out between cars and curbs. I passed out, and I would come to out in the bayous. I would be in a chug-a-lug contest with the chosen few in the Bastille bar as I came out of a blackout, not knowing how I had done this, and let's just keep going because you don't ask questions in that kind of situation. My life became more violent. The guy that I was living with had a heroin habit, and he didn't understand my alcoholism. I didn't understand his heroin habit. And he would give me a black eye or two, and he'd pass out, and I'd kick him once or twice. And my parents came to visit us when I lived in that situation, and they saw how I was living, and they saw daughter number two. She wasn't there anymore. There wasn't even resemblance of who she was anymore. I was living above a biker bar. They found me with a new black eye, with this guy with a pet snake he put in my father's face. The skunk was running all over. He was calling me four-letter words in front of my mother, and this was my mother and father from Iowa that came to see if I was alive and well. And when they left to go back home that day, there was a part of me that died, because I knew that I couldn't, that nothing would change if I went home with them. I wanted to crawl up in the back seat and just drive home to Iowa with them, because I was tired. I was really tired of the way I was living. But I knew I had no choice, and I knew nothing would change. I felt like the victim. And my drinking continued. I ended up in a lot of situations that I hope I never have to end up in again, that by seconds and inches, Norm used to talk about seconds and inches, by seconds and inches I got out of those situations. To get God's grace, a free gift, to come in to be an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of people sitting a block, two houses from here, that can't get their hands off of a bottle to get to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and we're here. You know, it's really an unearned gift, and I have to believe that. And a friend of mine was shot and killed on Mardi Gras Day, 1975. I was 2 feet inside the door in a blackout, and I should have been right next to him. And that day it was seconds and inches for me. And I ended up in New York, and from New York I ran. I ran to the West Coast. I ended up at Barney's Beanery. I started drinking at Barney's Beanery, the Rain Check Room, and Rudy's Bar, where a lot of the members of this group drank. Pretty sick places. They were 6 o'clock in the morning type of bars with the mailman, you know. You sit with the mailman and play dominoes before they go out on their route. And my drinking was, some nights it would work for me and some nights it wouldn't work for me. Sometimes I could sit there and have 14 shots of tequila and I'd be clear as a bell. And sometimes I'd have 2 shots and go immediately into a blackout and not know where I was until I came to a day or two later. And I had no more choice of the matter. I had to drink. I ended up back in New Orleans and my old friends wouldn't talk to me and people didn't want to hire me back. Lower Decatur Street, where you could smell the bar walking down where I had worked for the last time, didn't want to hire me back because I had a bad attitude. And I ended up running to Hawaii, except I didn't make it. I ended up at Barney's Beanery again, where I met my Eskimo to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a girl named Chris. Chris had a big book under her arm, and she was going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I took my rock glass full of Jose Cuervo Gold, and I said, good for you, Chris. She was so drunk, they had to call her a taxi. I said, go to your ANA. Good for you. Little did I know that she was going to lead me to Suzanne Selby, who brought me to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got on the back of a Harley on July 27th because they asked, and I loved Harleys and I loved bikes, and they said, let's go to Palm Springs, and I said, sure. And we went out to a nightclub, and they began to drive away, and I said, where are you going? And they said, well, we just need a little extra weight for the back tire. So we looked around at the bar, and we found the fattest one, and it was you. So we called you out of the bar to be a little extra weight. See ya. That's what I had become. I was 170 pounds of bloated meth. I used to wear a big red dashiki, a Panama hat, and there were blotches on my cheeks all the time from liver. And I didn't look in the mirror, and I didn't bathe, and I didn't care where I was going to sleep that night, but I had to drink. It was so important that I had a drink in front of me at all times. And I ended up at this bar, and I met a couple of guys. I don't remember how I met them, and I don't remember how I got to where I ended up, but they ended up beating me up somewhere that night, and they broke my jaw through places and raped me and broke my nose. And I was so heavy, they drug me out to the car that I had bruises and scratches on all parts of my body because they couldn't lift me. And they took me outside of town, and they rolled me off the side of the road, where you wouldn't have seen me if you would have driven by, and I was face down in the sand when I came to, bleeding from my face with no clothes on. And what happened was I heard the car door slam, and then I heard a voice, and the voice was not my voice, the voice was a power much greater than me, and the voice said, get up, I want to live. And I heard it, and I paid attention, and I got up the side of that road, and I walked down, and I guess I found somebody's condominium, and I guess I passed out in a lawn chair by the pool where a gardener found me, called the police, and there I was in a hospital lying on a gurney, writing down these answers to the questions the police were asking me. I couldn't talk because my jaw was hanging off my face. And I had to write when they would ask me questions. And I saw something on that clipboard that made my heart stop. And it was a word that was in front of my name. And the word was victim. And I thought, God, they finally know. They finally know. And for a moment, I felt elated. But then that voice came back that day going into surgery. That voice said, you know what? It's not your dad's fault you're lying here on this gurney today. It's not George who broke your heart at 18, your sister, the Mensa, that Catholic church. These guys didn't do this to you, Sharon. You did this to you. And it was a bit of truth I didn't know what to do with, but I heard it. I laid in the hospital for 2 weeks, and nobody sent me an airline ticket, and nobody bailed me out. I ended up living above the Duck Pond liquor store over in Overland and Palms with a man from that bar, Barney Feenery, who felt sorry for me. He would go off to work every day. He would buy me a gallon of red wine. I would stick a straw in the gallon of red wine. I would stick a straw through the wires on the mouth where the tooth had been, and I would suck on the red wine. And I was like drinking Kool-Aid, and there was no more elation out of alcohol. There was no more pass out of alcohol. I just maintained it. And I drank that way for, I don't know, maybe a week or 12 days. And then he told me I had to leave, and I called my mom. And my mom in Iowa had gotten a panic phone call from somebody at some hospital somewhere in California that her daughter had been badly beaten up and raped. But she didn't tell her what hospital I was at. So for 2 days, my mother in Iowa and my sister in New York called hospitals until they found me and found out that I was going to be okay. And my mother let me go. Because when I called her that day, I said, Mom, I need some money. I need something to keep me going right now because I have nowhere to go. And she said, Sharon, I can't help you. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army? And if my mother would have sent $20, it was seconds and inches from me, you would have another speaker. I don't know how she let go that day, and neither did she, but she let go. And I called Chris, because her number was there, the girl in the bar I had known. Chris said, I can't help you, but Suzanne can. Chris was not sober that day. Chris did not make Alcoholics Anonymous. I met her in St. John's Hospital for the last time, and she was in that program once again, and she was in a wheelchair, and she looked old, and she had some drool coming down her cheek, and there was no one home in her eyes. And Chris died of this disease. Not everybody gets to keep it, you know. A lot of people get a chance, but it's daily maintenance. It's a program, a spiritual program, based upon daily maintenance and surrender. You know, surrender. She gave me this number of Suzanne. I called Suzanne, and she sent two women right over to get me. And I had no idea where I was going or what I was in for. These two girls put me in the back of the Volkswagen, and we drove to a meeting of Echo Park where the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous met on Wednesday night. We went up to this church, and I thought, oh, God, here we go. They're going to sprinkle something on me. They're going to ask me to commit myself forever. They're going to use that word eternity forever. Here we go. And the man stuck out his hand, and it was John D. in our group. He stuck out his hand, and he was well-dressed, and I thought he's going to take me in the kitchen now because I don't look real good and tell me to sit back here until I can clean up. He just put out his hand, and he used one word, which made a difference that night, and the word was welcome. And if you're new, I welcome you. I am glad you are here. I ended up sitting in the front row. They seemed to be real proud and happy I was there. I didn't get it. I don't know how they knew I was new. It just seemed like I got a lot of attention. I passed the 20 questions with 17. A guy named Maurice gave me this book. I gave him my last quarter because nobody's going to give me anything. Maurice was later very important in my life. He told me I was one of the few newcomers who paid off that book. I gave him a quarter every other week until I didn't owe him anything. Because God forbid I should owe you people something. You know, I remember when I had no money and people would give me change and I would write it down. I had to pay them back. And one night an old-timer saw me writing this list down. He said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm going to have to pay these people back. And he said, no. The way we want to be paid back is for you to pass it along to somebody someday when they need it. Oh, what a concept. I really like that. You know, it freed me up to accept. There were all kinds of concepts in life I didn't understand. I didn't understand a day at a time. Someone asked me if I wanted to ride tomorrow night, and I said, it's a day at a time. I can't make a decision. And they said, no, that's not what it's all about. Emotionally, are you okay right now? Are you okay right now? You know, and if you're a good newcomer, you got to give them 2 minutes of making them stand there while you spin the Rolodex in your brain, and it always lands on the same answer, which is fine. So I told him I was fine, and he said, then that's what we're talking about, but you can make plans. Look at my calendar, and he showed me his calendar. He had a lot of commitments. So he explained that simple, stupid slogan that people laugh about, you know, explained that to me. I started in this group with absolutely nothing, and that, you know, they'd say to me, I'd say, but I have no money. I have to go to court. They caught these guys. They'd say, oh, easy does it. Don't drink and use in between meetings, and come tomorrow night. Don't, you know, it'll be all right. And I said, but you don't understand. I don't have any. Just come to another meeting. I don't know how it got from that point to when I got my own little place for $24 a week. I got my own telephone, and I got a waitress job, and I got a car, and I got car insurance. I don't know how it all happened. I don't know how it happened that when I didn't raise my hand for 30 days, I didn't even miss it. That's God's grace. That obsession was totally lifted from me. I drank all the time. There was always a bottle in my purse if there wasn't a bottle at the bar. I had to have alcohol, and then I didn't even miss it. I was totally amazed. That's really God's grace. That has never happened to me before in my life. I did not even want to quit drinking. And here I had 30 days of sobriety. I got a little attention until a woman named Pat Y came along, and she came along 8 days after me. I do have 8 more days than Pat. And she seemed to get a lot of attention. And every time I'd want a drink, I'd look over at Pat and I'd think, nah, then I'll have less time than her. So I stayed here. And a lot of things happened. I got a lot of early commitments. I remember when I was waitressing Christmas Day, we had to go to an Alcathon. And there were a bunch of people in this group that went. And I was feeling sorry for myself. I had to go to work on Christmas morning. And I walked into that restaurant and there they all were, having Christmas morning breakfast with me. And they left me a lot of tip and it was a lot of fun. And I felt really loved. You know, that's the kind of love I got here. I got active love. I got people caring for me. When they drove me home to that liquor store and I was living there, their sponsor said, now wait for the lights to turn off before you send her upstairs. They didn't want to sit there and talk to a stinking newcomer, but they were that was love. They gave me a chance. And that's what we do here, is I see, you know, love in my actions. I see God in my actions a lot of the time. I don't see God when I look in the mirror, but I see God in my actions. And I see God in your eyes and in your actions. And that happens a lot. It's a dynamic program. It happens now. I got to get married when I was 2 years sober. I got the opportunity to get married, and all of you came, and it was a lot of fun. And my father and my mother and my sisters came. And they looked at you, and my father looked at you and said, Sharon, your life is great. Look at you. You've got it made. And a neat thing happened. The angels didn't sing, and the earth didn't tremble. What happened was I knew I had my own approval. I had a little bit of worth and a little bit of approval of my own. And I agreed with my father. It wasn't like, thank God, Dad, you finally approved. What had happened was I had worked some of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had worked through the first five steps before I was 1 year sober, barely. I almost got drunk over my fourth step. I ended up at the airport, and I was going to leave because I had to go have my slip. That's all I heard. I'm glad I had my slip. I was only listening to people coming back. I wasn't listening to people who never came back, you know. But my thinking was starting, and I wasn't talking to the sponsor. And I called her from the airport, and she said, fine. Go ahead and have your slip. Be like my friend Stella. She was a long, raven-haired beauty, and she wouldn't finish her inventory either, she added. And she went home and burned up in a bed on her slip. Go have fun. Well, it kind of took the fun out of my going to go have a slip, you know. I think that you know, they go to the sponsor school, and they look up the Stella story when their baby's going to go have a slip. But what happened was she made me so mad that I went and I wrote. I sat at the airport and wrote. And I go to the airport to write all my inventories. It just seems to work for me. And I felt really good about taking my first year birthday cake. I got to go back to New Orleans in 1980. And with the Pacific Group, a whole plane load of you, so it wasn't so scary. And it was the International Convention down there. And I got to walk the haunts and see the people and be an example and make my amends. And I got to take all of you to see the last place where I lived. I remember I was on this death march. I had no idea it was so far. Clancy said, let's see where you used to live. And so, I don't know, there were probably about 35 of us. And so I just started walking, and it was hot, and it was July. And Clancy starts frothing at the mouth because it's hot, and we don't know where we're going, and how much further is it? And I'm with Maurice. Maurice is walking with me in the front. He's like, just keep walking, Sharon, just keep walking. I said, I think it's about 2 more blocks, Maurice. I'm not sure. He's like, just keep walking. And so we kept walking. We finally got to this place. I was so glad it was still there. And you know, he walked up to me. I thought Clancy was going to just froth at the mouth, and he was so hot and thirsty, and what was I doing and on this death march. And he propped me up in front of the gate of this apartment in the French Quarter, and he said, okay, guys, how do you think Sharon needs to pay for her last apartment? And without even missing a beat, all the men reached for their wallet, and I put my hand out, and somebody snapped a picture. And it's just one of my prized possessions, because Ramon is in it, and some other people that are very important in my life. And then we went to a place called Buster Holmes where they had beans and rice for 95 cents, and they just closed their doors. And we begged them. I begged them to open up. Please, there's this man. He's hungry. He's thirsty. Open the doors. And we went in there, and I went behind the bar and started popping open root beers for everybody. And they fed us beans and rice, and they started bringing out all their real cooking way back in the kitchen. And we all ate and had a great time and sang a Mickey Mouse when we left. And I felt so good about being a positive example of Alcoholics Anonymous in that town. I got to try to 12-step my old roommate. I stood in front of her for 5 minutes, and she didn't even recognize me. I tried to 12-step Robin, a friend of mine, one of my best friends in that town. She was so drunk, I have a picture of her in her cocktail waitress uniform coming apart, lying on my bed at the Hyatt with the big book under her arm, passed out. And I just thought, oh, well, you know, I just did what I could do. And the joy of it is, Casey and I got to go back to New Orleans last April. And we got to all go to Antoine's for dinner. And I was there with Casey, and we were sober. Robin was there, sober, with her husband. My friend Denny was there, sober. And we had a private room and a celebration of sobriety at Antoine's. I had always wanted to eat there, and I had never been able to get it together when I lived there to do it. And as we walked down Bourbon Street to go 12-step, an old jazz singer we knew, who could only do about 3 tunes in a row now without a long break, we were walking down Bourbon Street, and I had on like a Chanel suit with gloves, and Robin had a mink, and everybody looked good, you know. The men were in their suits and ties, and there was a glow about it. People looked at us like, who are these people? And I would look in those bars, and I would see me sitting on those stools with my head passed out, down the next corner, vomiting on my shoes, passed out between a car and a curb. I saw me, you know, and it's just seconds and inches. How did I get from there to here? Because of a loving God, a surrender in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to make amends to my dad. It was real important for me to do that. But things were still a little tense in my life, and I had a sponsor, 5 years sober, named Ginny, who had me call him up and ask him how much money I owed him. And I thought, well, we're not going to get into that now, are we? We've already done our amends. We've looked at our own character defects, and, you know, we pray every day. But what is this money stuff? You know, I'm not rich here. And she said, why don't you just be willing and call him up and ask him? So I called up my father, and I asked him. And without missing a beat, my father gave me a figure. Now, that really ticked me off, huh? My dad had been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know he read that book because he reads things, and he probably sat home with a calculator table in Cold Night in Iowa and worked it all out, because Karen will get there. When she gets there, give her the bottom line. And I called her back, and I said, you know what, it's too much, and he was too quick with that answer, and she said she didn't care. Loving sponsors. And she said, well, how much can you afford? And we talked about that. She said, in 2 days, call him back and ask him. So I did that. And I thought, good, 2 days, he'll mellow out a little. He'll remember. I didn't go to Europe like the rest of the kids. I didn't pay for my own college, you know. He'll remember that he didn't buy me a car. And he'll remember those things. But he accepted my terms. And so I called her back, and I said he accepted. She said, well, then don't be late with those checks. You are an example of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only one he may ever see. You are not to be late with that check. And then she said, are you really willing to grow? You know, they wait for you to really be willing and hurt a little and be surrendered and come to them on your knees, and then they just want more. You know, that's just the way they are. You know? They take you to the edge of the cliff. They grab you by the nape of the neck. They say, okay, look down, take a good look. You know, you want up or down. Okay. You know, do what you want. So I ended up saying yes, and she said, put a note about your life, a little newsy note on what you're doing with your life. I said, he doesn't care. She said, do it anyway. So I did it anyway, and I ended up doing this for over 3 years to my father. And at one point there, I told her I didn't have the money, I wasn't going to send it. She said, he's putting it into a trust fund for you, so I would send it anyway. Well, you know, smart sponsor, I sent it early for about the next 3 months after that. My father called me. My dad never called me. My father called me between Christmas and New Year's 1 year, after I'd done this for about 3.5 years, and said, Merry Christmas, Sharon. I don't want any more of your money. Please don't send me any more of your cash. Your debt with me is free and clear, but don't stop sending me your notes. And it was like the Christmas elves cut those little chips off my shoulders, and I was able to guilt-free because of working the amends step of Alcoholics Anonymous when I didn't even believe in it. Because of that, I got to walk into a brand new relationship where I get to be my father's little girl. Where I get to look at my dad, give him a hug, and tell him I love him, and not feel bad inside. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me so much freedom. I got elected secretary of this group in 1983, and then I got pregnant. I mean, I don't know if it was hand in hand, but I grew that year. That's definitely true. And 1984, Al and I had a baby boy, and I got to name my baby boy after my grandfather. I never got to make amends to. And Wesley was born, and Wesley has been raised with all of you. You watched him grow up. You watched him grow up from a little baby to an 8.5-year-old who Sister Sheila and Sister Mary get on a regular basis. And I send my son to that school because he was lost in kindergarten. He was totally lost. He needs love and discipline, and it has made a difference having these sponsors here with my amends to the Catholic Church. I get to bring my God in and out of that church with me. Because I have a loving God, more than just Deacons Moving Van. Deacons was my first one. They said, pick something, I picked Deacons. You know, my son points out Deacons now when we're driving down the road, you know, especially when we're having a talk, you know. He seems to find them. He's very good at that. But Wesley is 8.5 years old. He's been raised with all of you. You were there when he was born. You were there when he was baptized. You were there at his first communion. You were there at his birthday parties. You were there when he skinned his knee. You know, you've been there. You've been there. He is definitely a wonderful, spirited, brilliant child, and he has program in his life, you know, because you've taught me how to be with him on his level and to slow down and to be with him. And that has made all the difference in the world. And I've been able to give him what I've learned here, how to get through life and how to understand life when you feel like you were missing the day they gave out the rules. I went through a really bad divorce when I was 10 years sober. It wasn't much fun. And Clancy was my sponsor, and he had me work those steps when one night I finally surrendered. And my ex and his new step, my new stepwife, was across. They were across the room, and I was headed towards them one night with two hot cups of black coffee. And I was going to say hello. And Clancy stopped me that night. He happened to be in town that Saturday night, and he took the coffee out of my hands, and he looked me square in the eyes and said, "Sharon, you walk through this with dignity and grace." And if he would have stopped there, I would have said, "Screw dignity and screw grace, Clancy. I hurt." But he said, "So you can be an example to the others." And I heard him. And I started to surrender and give up and walk through that hallway. It was just a hallway. I got to be rocketed into the fourth dimension when I walked through that other door 1 year, 1 month, and 14 days later. You know, nobody had to get drunk. You know, Jill is sitting in this room and she's one of my best friends. You know, my ex is here, Al, and things are great between us. You know, he's my friend. You know, it's amazing that nobody had to get drunk and that we all work a spiritual program and it works. It really works here. I get to sponsor people, and it's been one of the joys of my life. I remember sponsoring this sullen woman who would never even look up, you know, and just a hard look on her, and she's one of my best friends today. That gives me so much heart, so much love. And a woman walked into my life named Beth who was so drunk I had to tie her shoes at her first meeting. And then a year later, we went out to Upland to watch her finish a marathon, you know, because she's sober a year, and your eyes are bright, and her shoes are tied. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to give this program away. It has given me a sense of purpose. You know, I have a good job. I've been there 6 years. They keep promoting me. They like me there. All I do is show up, put a smile on my face, do my work. You know, I try to stay out of what's going on and just do the best job I can and learn and be an example of this program. I have a relationship in my life that really is on the spiritual level that I have never known in my life. You know, I get to be with you on a regular basis to be reminded of what it could be like. And if I really want to go back there, all I have to do is leave for a while because then my head will start. Then I think that my case is different. When I come and I'm with you, something happens when two or three are gathered together. One alcoholic talking to another. There's something that opens up inside of me that I never knew was there before. It is God. You know, I stood here when I was 7 years sober from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes, and the first time in my life, I knew what Chuck C. talked about when he meant that we are God's kids because I felt it. It went all the way through me, a spirit that was light and beautiful and innocent. You know, I never thought I could have that sense of innocence in my life. I never thought that I would have the sense of freedom I have, of choice, and freedom to go out in the world and hold my head up high with dignity and grace. I had no idea that my life could be like it is today. And when I went back to my parents' 50th anniversary, I should have just been a memory. I should have been framed in black up on the wall with all those other pictures. I was so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous had allowed me to live long enough to watch my parents turn 50. I sat at home and I sat in that kitchen and Wesley was playing with his Legos. He wanted to be a cop or an architect, so I buy him a lot of Legos. And my dad was reading the paper and my mother was cooking her wonderful smelling food and the locusts, it was a hot Iowa night and the locusts were doing their song, you know, and the fireflies were coming out. And the sun was setting and everything was peaceful. And there was a feeling that came over me that I never thought would happen. It was a feeling of belonging to that family. And it went all the way through me. There's a lot of healing, love, and power here. You have to pick up the simple set of spiritual tools that are laid at your feet by the people that have been there. You know because you've been there. When I walked in here and you read my mail, I didn't understand, but I knew you had been there. My first speaker at my first meeting said, "You waited for the spaceship to land and say you could come home now, Bill." And I knew he knew how I felt. I came to you with broken shoes, broken spirit, broken jaw, torn clothing, stinking, smelling a mess. I came to you like that, and you saw something in me worth saving, and you shared your message one-on-one. You gave me the simple set of spiritual tools. So if you're new, please join us. There is a solution. Thank you.
The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. It is our primary problem. If our primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Hi, my name is Frank, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Richard W.
My name is Richard. I'm a real alcoholic. I want to thank Frank for asking me to speak. It's an honor and privilege to speak in front of my home group. And tonight, I'm not going to lie up there. I'm going to tell what it was like and what happened and why I'm here in AA. And I'm a native Californian. I was born in Beverly Hills. And I come from a nice Jewish family, and I drank too much wine, like Beverly Acorn says. I'm a nice Jewish boy, and I drank too much wine. That's what got me here. And I was all mixed up when I was born. I didn't know where I was at. And my mother wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer in the Jewish religion. If you weren't that, they looked down on you like the black sheep of the family. And she still has to speak to me today. She knows I'm an AA. But she told me to stay here and mind my own peace and cue. And this is the longest I ever been in AA. 15 more days, I'll have 11 years if I make it. And I'm going to start out by saying I went to all the better schools. My mother wanted me to go to all the better schools. I went to Fairfax High School in the early 50s. I'm a product of the 50s and 60s. I did all my drinking there. I didn't get in too much trouble when I was drinking. I was mainly a bum off the streets of L.A., but I did like to do one thing. I don't know what was the matter with me, but I thought I had some mental problems because I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I used to go to all the racetracks in California, and that was my main thing, was to gamble. But I drank pretty heavy, and when I drink, I go after her. And 9 times out of 10, I would get them in the bar, and what I would do, I would take them to a motel instead of having fun with them. I would tie them up and beat them up. So I did that for a while, too. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I thought I had some mental disorder. And I went and decided the Korean War broke out in 1950, and it was the tail end of it in 54. And I decided to go downtown. I saw a big sign that said, Marine Corps Build Men. I said, well, I think I want to go in there. And I went down there, and my amazement, I passed the test, and they put me in the Corps of Recruit Depot in San Diego, and I didn't like it right when I got there because some guy in a brown hat got us off the bus and started calling us all kind of nasty names, and I told him where to go, and I decided I had enough of it after 15 months and decided to get the hell out of there. I got out on an honorable discharge, and that's when my drinking really took off. I was drinking pretty heavy and wandering around the streets. I had about 60 different jobs. I couldn't hold any jobs, and I was just all messed up. And I had nowhere to go, and my mother wouldn't help me, and I caused her a lot of problems. I like to terrorize her a lot. She put me I was in Norwalk for a year, under Thorazine and Melorol, and all the kind of, and I was locked up in the VA for a year, too. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong. My mind was going faster than my head. And today, you know, I'm just a normal person. You know, I don't go to racetrack anymore, but I think about going there most of the time. And I can't work. I'm on the low income bracket. I'm on SSI right now, and I have a lot of things going wrong, but I'm still standing here. My higher power wants me to be here today, and my best friend just died October 2nd, and I'm still a little shook up over that. And I just have a good life today, and what I do, I go to 7 meetings a week. I got about 10 commitments, and I show up at every one of them, and I don't want to show. And my sponsor, Larry Gary, I want to mention his name, he makes me go to a yard when I don't want to go either. And I don't like that yard, but I go there because I follow his direction. You know, today I live a clean life, and it's all due to aim. I try to be a man. I work in the steps, and I just took an inventory. I had Dave Hardy for 4 years, and we took an inventory, and, you know, I just live a normal now. I'm trying to, you know, reach my old age, get a pension, and, you know, just live a normal human being. I never had a chance before because I was always mixed up when I was young. I used to fantasize a lot, and when I was younger, I had an operation, and the doctors messed my voice up, and I grew into fantasy land, and it was the era when Elvis Presley and Chubby Checker. And I just thought I would work for Elvis Presley and be his manager. And I used to go around wearing tight pants and body shirts. And, you know, I don't do that anymore. And You know, today I'm different. You know, I'm finally finding out after almost 11 years. That's the longest I've ever been sober, but stayed in one spot. And I've been with my roommate, Wayne Owen, now for almost 7 years. He's also my doctor and hairstylist. And, you know, we get along pretty good. And that's a miracle for me because I'm known as a runner. When things are good, I like to mess up. And I did a lot of harm to my mother, you know, Sunday's Mother's Day, and she still don't talk to me, and I can't go over there because if she does, you know, she'll call the police on me, and that really hurts me. And, you know, I'm trying to make amends to her, and I'm going to send her a Mother's Day card, and, you know, I'm just trying to live a normal, straight life, and I don't know when this green light is going on, but I'm just getting nervous up here. And, you know, if it wasn't for AA, I would have been out there dead or probably gone for what I did. And, you know, today, I'm just glad I'm here in AA. I live a normal life. You know, I got a mailbox with my name on it, and my roommate bought me a phone the other day, too. You know, and that's something that I never had either. And, you know, I don't have many material things, but, you know, I got things to keep me here in AA, you know, like these people and yards, my sponsor. I call my sponsor every day, and I don't like calling them every day, and sometimes I follow his directions, and sometimes I don't. And, but, you know, me and Larry's one of the better sponsors around, and he tells me like it is, and I have to listen to him. And as the other things go, well, I just take it one day at a time. And when I was, you know, living at home, my mother, you know, she was afraid to have me there. So that's why she put me in Norwalk. I was in Norwalk and Brentwood. And when I was in Brentwood, I was strapped down. And I was on Thorazine and Melazine because they couldn't figure out what was wrong with my mind. And I think I see a green light coming. I don't know what that means. But I'm just going to say I did one other bad thing to my family, too. One night I got real drunk, and she wouldn't let me in. And she gave me a check for $10,000 to stay away, you know. And she said I stole it, and because I was gambling pretty heavy at the time. And I would go to Santa Anita, Hollywood Park, in Del Mar, and then I started losing. And I came back to get me money, and I knocked on the door. She wouldn't let me in. I broke the door down. I ran in the bathroom, and what I did, I banged my head on the toilet, I think, and it started throwing up. And I looked on the back table there, and I saw something sitting there, and I couldn't believe my eyes. I saw a pair of gold teeth, and she's about 80 years old. And what I did, I put the teeth in my pocket and walked out. And cracked it, and sold it, got $200, and went to the track. You know.
Turn the tape over now, please.